Yesterday, we began talking about issues in relation to Native Americans, or as I prefer to call them, Indian people. The reason we're having a topic like this at Holden is that despite the years and years and years and years that our government and our church and our people have been neighbors to and next to Indian people, the issues between the white America and Indian people are far, far from resolved. And in fact, in many places, they're getting more and more tense and more difficult. I pointed out yesterday that Carola and I come from northern Wisconsin. We live in the country in northern Wisconsin. Northern Wisconsin has 9 Indian reservations, and there's always been a lot of tension between Indians and non-Indians in northern Wisconsin, but it's rising again after a period of 8 or 10 years of kind of a calm, because the courts in Wisconsin have ruled that Indian treaties indeed do give Indians rights to hunt and fish outside the normal game seasons. And this has enraged a lot of people, white people in northern Wisconsin, just actually enraged them, because they say that Indians have rights that white people don't have. And so we have 2 organizations that have organized, of white right groups, white rights. And they have put out a lot of propaganda. They're trying to get the government to abrogate the treaties. And in order to finance their effort, they have put out a beer, and it's called Treaty Beer. And the labels on it are Treaty Beer, and it says we support white American rights against Indians. And this beer is being sold all over northern Wisconsin, and the profits from it go to white supremacist groups. And then we have a bumper sticker that says, shoot an Indian and save a deer. Now that's just in our area. I'm sure that some of you could tell stories about what is happening in your area. And yesterday, we talked about 2 of the issues that are between Indian and non-Indian people. One of the issues we talked about yesterday is land. And we talked about how Indian people over the last 3 or 4 centuries have gradually lost their land. Until now, they are constricted to very small and unprofitable reservations. Then we talked yesterday about the availability of services to Indians. Under the treaties, the American government, back in the 1880s and 90s and 70s, guaranteed certain services, health, education, food and supplies, and clothing and so on, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs to protect the rights of Indians. None of those have come through to Indians the way the government has promised, and now a lot of white people are saying, let's wipe out the treaties. Those are 100 years old now, and we ought to just wipe them out. And of course, it's a moral issue in our country. Can you abrogate a promise that was once made whereby you took away the rights and the land of a certain number of people, and now you want to take away the services that were guaranteed to them in perpetuity by our government? Well, that's what we talked about yesterday. Today, I'd like to get into a different aspect of, what shall I say? It isn't as much conflict between white and Indian people as it is a wide gap and a wide difference. And that has to do with culture and religion. Culture and religion. Now, one of the interesting things that Carola and I have run into as we have been with Indian people has been that a lot of white people look rather bewildered when you talk about Indian culture and religion, and they say, why can't they just join us and be like us? You know, after all, we're the majority people, and it's up to Indians to assimilate and to become like us. And a lot of white people are very, very puzzled about this. They cannot understand why native peoples in this country just can't recognize the superior quality of the civilization that we have brought to this country and join it. After all, we're wealthier than they are, we are better educated than they are, we have our society organized better than they do according to our lights, and we have a better religion, and so on and so on and so on, and they can't understand why Indian people are not, many, I don't say all Indian people, but many Indian people are not willing to become like white people. Many of them do, but a great many Indian people and an increasing number of Indian people are going back to their cultural and religious heritage. And that becomes a puzzle to, and frequently a problem for a great many non-Indian people. Well, I'd like to just say some words about culture and religion, and then I'd like to open it up for your comments and questions and discussion. And again, as I said yesterday, you don't have to agree. Kroll and I have dealt with white groups many, many times, and we find that a lot of people just don't agree with us on what we say. Please feel free to disagree. We don't have all the answers either. In fact, I don't even have very many answers. Well, I'm a white person, and Kroll is white, and we really ought not to be talking about Indian culture and Indian religion. So I'm going to talk about it from what we have observed as white people. Secondly, I told the group yesterday that we have been through some rather significant experiences with Indian people, including my being arrested and sentenced to prison for certain relationships with Indian people. And we've been through a lot of things with Indians, and many Indian people have included us into many of their cultural and religious ceremonies and exercises and so on, so that we at least have had some personal experience of some of the things that I'd like to talk about. First of all, there's a rich tradition of culture and religion in most Indian groups, a very rich tradition, going way back to prehistoric times. The interesting thing about Indian people is that they don't separate out their religion from their culture. Religion is sort of a part of all life. And life is a religious kind of thing, a spiritual kind of thing. It's not religion in the same sense that we think of religion in terms of church and ritual and liturgy, although there's some of that in Indian life too. But there's a sort of a totality about Indian life where the ceremonies, the religious acts, the spiritual kinds of expressions get mixed up with hunting and fishing and preparation of food and social life, family life, and all the rest of it. It becomes kind of a cyclical thing. And for us who are used to secular thinking and religious thinking, and the two don't often really go together, that's a very hard thing to grasp, how that religion sort of relates across the board to the whole gamut of Native American life. Now, two things happened very early on. One was that with the very first explorers who came to this country from Europe, came missionaries. Priests came with them. Because the explorers who came to this country and the ones who followed them were blessed by the church in Europe, and the church commissioned them to go out and to convert the heathens, and not only in the United States, but all over the world. And this was done in the colonial process. So that very, very early in the contact between white and Indian people, there was immediately an outreach by the church to do two things. One was to expose the non-Christian heathenism of the natives, and secondly, to convert those natives to Christianity, to a European-style Christianity, not to a Christianity that sort of fitted into this kind of a milieu, but a Christianity that was a European-style Christianity, transferred right out of the Latin mass and everything else right into the Indian world. And so that was the first thing that happened. The second thing that happened was that when the American government was formed, it concluded, as the years went by, that the preservation of native culture and the preservation of native religion was dangerous to the growing unity of the United States. It was dangerous to the growing expansion westward, because the culture and the religion kept Indian people in the minds of the American government, kept them worked up against whites. It culminated in the late 1800s in a law that forbade Indian tribes to engage in religious ceremonies. Now, if you can countenance that under the American Constitution, which so zealously has guarded the rights of American people to practice religion as they will, that there was actually a law on the books that forbade Indian ceremonials between the 1880s and, guess when? 1975. That law was finally abrogated by Congress in 1975 under what was called the Freedom of Religion Act. As far as I know, Native Americans, Indians, are the only group of people in the history of this country that were forbidden by law to practice their religion. And so from the 1880s up until 1975, there was a suppression of Indian culture and Indian ceremonials and Indian religious expression. Now, it wasn't wiped out entirely, but it was done quietly, off on reservations where no white people were around, and so on. But by and large, the expression of Indian religion and culture was wiped out. I think many of us are old enough here to think back to the 20s and 30s, 40s and 50s. We heard very little about Indian culture and religion, except for movies that showed Indians with headdresses and sometimes going around, la 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 la, you know, and singing and dancing. But it was mostly in the movies. We never saw those things happen, or very rarely did. So very early on, there was a strong effort to wipe out Indian culture and Indian religion and to make those people be like us. Now, of course, us were never unified either, you know. But most of us have, the United States has come out of a basically European culture and European religious background. And so consequently, even though we've had a great many differences in this country, yet there is a kind of a unifying culture on the religious force that goes on in this country. Okay. Beginning in the 1960s, when other groups were beginning to rebel, many of you remember the 1960s when all kinds of things were questioned. You will remember that the women's movement began in 1960s, and the feminist, I shouldn't say that. It certainly began earlier than that. But let's say it began to come to our consciousness in the 1960s. Feminism began to begin to have its advocates, both by women and men. You'll remember the youth rebellion, where young people began to question all the values of us older people, and began to do all kinds of stuff that we were horrified at. You remember the anti-Vietnam War movement that began at that time. And we remember the uprising of blacks and the coming forth of Chicano peoples. And at that time, Native American, Indian people also began to become conscious of the fact that they too needed to express themselves, and so movements grew up, some of them quite radical, like the American Indian movement, which Kroll and I have been associated with. And they insisted on a return to their native cultures and a return to their native spirituality. And that began to happen. And it's happening more and more and more. Kroll and I have been in recent years in many ceremonies. In fact, we were in one about, 3 weeks ago in Minneapolis, where there were about 3 or 4 hundred Indian people who had a feast in one of the parks. They had a big dance, and Kroll and I were out in front dancing in 94 degrees and no trees around. And the Indians don't know when to stop, and we kept dancing and dancing until we were absolutely
honoring us.
Yeah, it was an honoring dance. And they had a big feast. And they had bear meat, and they had venison, and they had ham, and they had turkeys, and they had chickens, and they had fry bread, and they had all kinds of vegetables, and on and on. When Indians put on a feast, they really know how to put on a feast. They may be poor. In fact, I'd say out of those 300 Indians there, probably 250 of them were poverty-stricken Indians. But the others brought in venison and stuff from the reservations. They brought in, they just bring it in and they feast. And feasting is a big thing among Indians. They don't do it often, but when they do it, it's a big, happy event. It's like what's talked about in the Psalms, you know, in the Old Testament, when some of the Psalms say that the Lord will make you revel in fatness, you know, and things like that. That's the way Indian people like to do it. And we've been in quite a few of those kinds of things. We have been in sweat lodges. We were at a sweat lodge up in a reservation in northern North Dakota, just after we had been at Holden here 2 years ago in September. We went up to Rolla, North Dakota, and then up to the Indian reservation, and we were with a spiritual leader in a sweat lodge up there. We've been at the Sundance, which is kind of an ugly thing, but it has a great significance for Indians, where at the end of 4 days of dancing, several of the Indian men, it's always men, are pierced through the muscles of their breast, and they're attached by long thongs to a tall pole, and they dance around it until maybe for a day, until that tears loose. And it's really a difficult thing to deal with, but it has a very deep meaning for many Indian tribes, where some Indian people are willing to suffer symbolically for their people. So it's an interesting kind of thing. To culminate this, and then I'd like to open it for discussion. I could tell you a lot of different stories, but maybe they'll come up. But I'd like to open it for discussion now. I was in Denver 2 weeks ago at a meeting called by the Lutheran Church in America, the AELC and the ALC, which are going to join in this new Lutheran Church now called the ELCA, and brought together about 25 white ministers, Lutheran ministers, who are pastors to Indian congregations or Indian Lutheran agencies that are working with Indians. And the teachers at this conference were Indian people, two Indian spiritual leaders. And they were teaching white Lutheran pastors something about Indian spirituality. Now, this is fascinating because most of our white pastors who are serving native peoples really have very little comprehension of Indian spirituality. That's been becoming more and more plain. And it's been more and more plain that over the last couple of generations, when we have picked missionaries to go to Indian areas or Eskimo areas, We have often picked those missionaries who are full of missionary zeal and whose mind is focused on Christian doctrine and the exposition of Christian truth among Indian people, and who have had the attitude, by and large, that Indian people are heathens and need to be converted to Christianity. And I don't argue with that, except that certain things have come out in recent years which have really shocked the church. And I'll tell you one or two things. I did a study, not a heavy study, but I did a study some years ago of the states, beginning with Wisconsin and going westward across the north part of the United States out here to the state of Washington. Wisconsin, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. I found that of the major Lutheran church bodies, we have almost 600 Lutheran congregations in that stretch. Over 300 of those are within 10 miles of an Indian reservation. Over 300 of those are within 10 miles of an Indian reservation. And there aren't more than 200 or 300 Indian people who are members of those congregations. Well, when the church began to look at that and began to wonder why, all kinds of questions arose. What happened here? What's happened that in 200 or 300 years, while our Lutherans have been building themselves up in those states, we've never been able to touch Indian people? We send missionaries to China and Japan and Africa and South America and all over the place, but here are native peoples right in our own communities, right next door, with whom we have almost no contact. I've talked to many, many, many pastors who have churches within 10 miles of Indian, some right on Indian reservation, who don't even know an Indian person, can't even call an Indian person by name, and who live in close proximity. The Indian reservation where we were 2 years ago, up in North Dakota, there's an ALC congregation right on the edge of that reservation, within a mile of the border of the reservation. The town in which that congregation is located is half Indian, and there's not a single Indian member of that congregation, not a one. And so somehow there's been a gap between we white Lutherans, and I don't think it's only Lutherans, it's true also of other denominations, but certainly of we Lutherans, because I know the Lutheran Church. There's just a complete gap.
Well, the Catholics have a better track record, don't they, with the Indian people?
Well, Catholic, yes, indeed. Catholic missions among Indians go back to the very beginning of exploration of this country, when, like in our country, Father Hennepin and Father Nicolet and so on were in the 1600s, were in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And they have had missions, and there are Catholic churches on a great many reservations, but the Catholics too are finding that somehow they are no longer reaching Indian people. They've got a lot of Indian people who were converted to Catholicism back early on, but somehow that's not growing, and many of their mission stations are being closed up. It's a strange phenomenon. But I think what's happening is that Indian people are beginning to rediscover their own history and their own spirituality, and somehow our white Christian approach to Christianity does not fit with their cultural points of view. Now, as I said, there's a resurgence now. And at this conference we had in Denver, I'll just tell you one point that came out very clear. And this is something for us Christians to think about. This Indian spiritual leader said, "The problem we Indians have with your approach to Christianity is that you approach Christianity from you start with sin. You start with sin. And then you talk about the atonement of Christ. And he said, in our Indian history, sin, we don't think of sin in the same way you people talk about sin. We understand wrongdoing. But the way you people talk about sin doesn't fit with our historic look at things. He said, we Indian people like to start with creation. Our religion always starts with the act of creation, the Creator coming in and creating nature, the world, and human beings. And that's where we start. And then we move from there into the growth of our spiritual life. Whereas he said, you people come to us and start talking about sin, and we don't even know what you're talking about. And then he said, we don't see you people relating to the Creator and to the natural world the way our spirituality begins. So he said, if you Lutherans could listen to us for a while and learn how we think spiritually, maybe you would be able to bring a more effective witness about Christianity, about the meaning of Christianity. Well, that's something really, really tough to think about. And then he said one thing that really shook me up. He said, why don't you just follow your creed? Your creed starts with God the Father, Creator. You know, I believe in God, the Creator of all things, and so on. And then it goes to, I believe in Jesus Christ, and then it goes to the Holy Spirit. He said, you don't even follow your creed when you come to us and preach to us. He said, if you just would follow your creed, your religion would make a lot more sense to us. And it kind of shook up the group to think that all these years we've been trying to convey our Christian message in a way that for many Indian people just doesn't make sense, isn't comprehensible. So many of our pastors who are working with Indian people, I think, went back from this conference with a lot to think about that they hadn't really faced before. Well, okay. This poses a lot of problems for me, and maybe it does for you too, but I'm a Christian pastor. And Carol and I have learned to appreciate Indian culture. There's a lot of stuff, not just religion, but Indian culture that I really think is good stuff, very valuable stuff. And it's all mixed in with spirituality. And as a Christian pastor, I feel I need to make a Christian witness. But I have to make it in appreciation of these cultural values that we have perceived in the Indian world. And that creates quite a dilemma for me. I think it's creating quite a dilemma for the church. On Friday, we're going to talk about the new church. And you know, our new church has talked about inclusiveness. Well, if we're going to be inclusive, you know, we better do some thinking about some of this stuff. So Friday we're going to talk about that. But today I'd rather talk a little bit more about the culture. Okay, we've already gone for quite a long time. So would anybody like to raise a question or make a comment at this point? Or?
All right. Go ahead.
I think this lady back here, yeah.
Oh, this is just a reflection, not really a question. And that is, whenever we talk about ministry among Indians or other marginalized groups in the church, it always is thought of in terms of ministry to a particular people. And I happen to work with gay and lesbian Lutherans in San Francisco, and also I'm doing some work with AIDS, with Lutheran Social Services. And one of the things that has been brought to my attention is that there's a great deal of resentment experienced by this particular group of people, and I'm generalizing now to what I would imagine Native Americans to be experiencing, when they're perceived of as a group of people deserving some sort of charitable contribution on our part. And the way in which I've been enlightened is that what we need to be working toward is some sort of mutuality. And for me, when you begin to talk about Indian concerns, I right away think about contributions that Indian people can make to the Lutheran Church. And I love the idea, I mean, in talking about the conflicts that they experience when we import our particular Lutheran doctrines, beginning with sin, when that presents a conflict, I think that that can be perceived as a challenge to the way we understand our own theology.
Very good. That's great. We're going to get into that more on Friday when we talk about inclusiveness and how the church deals with that. But that's a very, very good point. Yeah.
To kind of continue on where she left off, I have a friend that I didn't understand what he meant for a long time and he'd been coming to Holden over many years now. Started back in like 1973. And he was very bitter to the point where he didn't want to go to church with me ever in Minneapolis. And because he didn't see the church looking after our world at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not the world, not the people itself, but the physical world. Mm-hmm. He didn't see us caring about our pollutants we put in the air.
Okay.
He didn't care about our,
mm-hmm.
you know, our, you know, the, whether we're going to be able to live here in a couple hundred years. And that kind of goes back to what you said about the Indians worrying more about the creation. They did take good care of the earth.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, the one thing that I keep thinking is that, you know, you were saying how over this large period of time from when we began missionary work on this continent and today, there's just really been sort of a stalemate as far as drawing mm-hmm. Indians into the Lutheran Church. Could it be because we're not reaching out, or could it be because they have a better way? I mean, we need to maybe learn, you know, maybe it's on purpose. They're sort of resisting.
Well, I let me say this. I've heard a lot of Indian people say that they believe they have a better way.
Yeah.
I've heard them say that. Now, I can't say that I believe that they have a better way, but I can say this. That now, in picking up on what you said here, we could go on with this for days, but Carl and I have observed three or four things that Indian people have in their cultural milieu, and that includes their spirituality, that I think clashes in many ways with our white American point of view. For instance, relation to nature. Simply put, most Indian people come out of a culture, and because they've been shoved on reservations in the last 100 years, they haven't been able to practice this, but many of them still feel it very strongly, that human beings live in cooperation with nature, that human beings live in the natural order of things, and that human beings have a responsibility to preserve the natural order. And that was always the Indian way. In fact, that's been the native way of peoples all over the world. Our white American culture has said nature is to be exploited. It's to be dominated. And so we mine it, and we cut down the trees, and we
kill the species,
overgraze it, and we overfish it, and everything else. And so, in many ways, we have violated that concept of the sacredness of the natural order. Now this is a slippery business, and it's hard to deal with. And I hate to say that I don't like to make Indians out as kind of a noble bunch of people who all love nature. That's not true. A lot of Indians have been corrupted so badly that by our culture, but by the fact that they can't practice this any longer. You can't practice that on a little reservation that doesn't have any resources. But that's one thing. the land, not just as a part of nature, but the land as a place. Indians think in terms of sacred places. We think in terms of sacred events. We think of that Abraham came out, and then we talk about Moses leading the people out, and then we talk about the coming of Christ, then we talk about Martin Luther. And our history is a timeline kind of history. The Indian traditional point of view is that there are sacred, that the land is sacred, and that there are sacred places that are very important to them. A lot of you have heard about the Black Hills, for instance. And that was one of the very sore points that led to Custer's downfall and so on, was that the Black Hills had been set aside by the American government because they were sacred to the Sioux Indian tribes. And the Sioux were a big, powerful group of Indian tribes back in the 1800s. But then gold was discovered in the Black Hills. And of course, white people came rushing in to mine the gold, and then Indians attacked them, and then the government felt they had to protect the gold miners and the settlers, and so they sent the troops in, and Custer was one of those, and we had this huge clash. But of course, the Indians were wiped out, and that was taken away. Now, the federal courts have recognized again that the Black Hills were indeed sacred Indian places. And about 3 or 4 years ago, the federal courts ruled that the Black Hills were taken from the Indians illegally. And of course, you know what a tension that has been causing. Our government offered the Indians $101.3 million to settle that claim on the Black Hills, and the Sioux Indians have turned that down. And a lot of white people can't believe that they would turn down $101 million. but in fact, that's the case. So land and place is very important. It's more like the old Hebrews. You know, they used to worship at certain places. The Hebrews had certain Jacob's Well and places like this were very important. Well, the Indian people have a perception like that. A third value is family. Family is very important, not just parents and children, but grandparents, uncles and aunts, cousins, etc. They have an extended family, and that still is very important among Indian people. Kroll and I have let me tell you one instance. We were up at Ashland, Wisconsin, where an Indian woman had just graduated from college, by the way. She was a woman in her late 40s and had 13 children when she enrolled at college in a small Northland college at Ashland. Well, after bearing 13 children and then going to college and commuting about 30 miles each day to go, she graduated.
Good.
Yeah, great. And Carl and I were invited to her graduation, so we went up there. And so they said, well, come over to the house out on the reservation afterward. We're going to have a little party. So we came. And we were there, and pretty soon other people began to come, and other people. We found that they were all uncles and aunts and cousins and second cousins and so on. Pretty soon there were about 40 or 50 people. They were all feasting around. Everybody brought something, and it was a great big family hoop-de-doo. By the way, the 13 children got together and gave their mother a present. They gave her an electric stove. She had always cooked on a wood stove. So anyway, family is very important.
What was her major?
Her major was Native American Studies. And then the next year she went down to the University of Minnesota in Duluth, northern Minnesota, and took a master's degree in Native American Studies. And the next year they put her on the faculty to teach. This was after the woman had born 13 children and had raised them up. Wow. Maybe some of you ladies could do that, but I can't. Well, these are some of the cultural, and I think it ties in with what you were talking about. And that's not just a secular kind of thing. It's part of the spiritual heritage of Indians. So when we go to bear Christian witness among Indians, we can't ignore these factors. They are very, very important.
Well, I have a real loose association in my mind, but I think that worshiping the nature and the land and the wilderness creatures and taking care of all them points back to the same God that we believe in. And we need.
There's one point that I'd like to make about what you said, and that is worshiping these. I don't think, as Kroll and I have talked about this, I don't think we find Indians worshiping the land, or worshiping nature, or worshiping the family. They see that as part of the spiritual cycle. Indians will view a tree as being sacred, but that doesn't mean they worship it. It means that they see it as part of the cycle of creation, see? Or they may apologize to a deer when they kill it, which many Indians do.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they worship the deer. It means that they recognize it and respect it as part of the natural order of God's being with us.
That doesn't mean.
But I agree with you on what you said.
Hasn't Matthew Fox, and especially in his book Original Blessing, kind of gotten back to some of these same ideas, only coming out of his Catholic?
Who is this?
Matthew Fox.
Yes, sure.
And
okay.
And so there is a movement, mm-hmm. you know, in Christendom towards looking at these things from
yes.
that perspective.
Of course.
So many of our ideas, it seems to me, in terms of missionary work, stem from our Victorian heritage,
mm-hmm.
when everything in our culture seemed to be going great. You know, we're expanding, industrial revolution taking place, all those things, and we incorporated that as if that were part of our Christian heritage. And it's just been passed down.
Mm-hmm.
And we've assumed that was Christian, so books like this and rethinking groups like yours are putting us back in touch with what was the real heritage that we have to
mm-hmm.
offer, what
okay.
they have to offer us,
yeah.
and getting us back, I think, on the track. And it's very hard to break those thought patterns that you were raised, it's very hard for me at least to break those thought patterns I've been raised with. I think, well, no, you've got to go out and preach this way, but you don't.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It would be enormously interesting to actually sit and listen to a spiritual leader in the Indian culture. Would they come and speak at our church anytime?
Well, yes and no. Some will and some won't. This has been a thing that Kroll and I have dealt with over the years. We had a program going in northern Wisconsin called New Beginnings. It was an attempt by the church to relate to Indian people. And one of the things we did was to bring groups of white people, like this group, onto an Indian reservation for 2 or 3 days, and then have the Indian people relate to them, maybe have a little feast or something, and then bring some spiritual leaders in to talk and help them get acquainted. Not all Indian people are willing to do that.
Doesn't the American Lutheran Church have an Indian Sunday once a year?
A what?
Indian Sunday?
Yes, we have an Indian Concern Sunday. The trouble is that's mostly fundraising. That's the way we raise money for Indians, and it doesn't give us any attachment to what I'm talking about here. It relieves our sense of guilt over not, we give them money, and it raises about $200,000 a year, and that makes us feel pretty good. You know?
But wasn't the church considerably divided at the time of the, this uprising in South Dakota, and whether the Lutheran should be doing this or not?
Oh yes, of course.
And even at the present time?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Paul was criticized. He got lots of letters from the church offices got letters from over 50 congregation in South Dakota saying that if they didn't fire Paul, that they would not support the church anymore. I mean, this is the type of, and then, but then he also got many letters from people saying this is the best thing that happened, that at least somebody is we finally are doing what our church has said we were going to do.
You're right, it's very controversial. All of this stuff is controversial. A lot of people will disagree heartily on any idea that we ought to appreciate Indian cultural heritage. They say it's heathen. Yeah.
We did hear at Holden about 3 years ago or so, there was an Indian woman who was here on staff. She was connected to prayer and things like that.
There are some Indian people who are willing to do that.
And at our...
When I was writing down this stuff here, I forgot one or two things that are most offensive to non-Indian people about Indian culture. One is time. Carl and I have just been upset many times when we've been with Indians at their lack of attention to time. You know, they say, we're going to have something going on at 10 o'clock in the morning. Well, you'd be there at 10 and nothing is happening, nobody's around, and maybe at 11 somebody shows up, maybe at 12 o'clock something will happen, you know, or something. We've even been at places where there was supposed to be something at 10 o'clock in the morning, didn't take place at 11 o'clock at night. And nobody paid any attention to it. But the worst part of it is that this has deeply affected attitudes, because when Indian people get a job someplace, whatever the job is, whether it's in the woods cutting wood or whether it's in the city as a machinist or what have you, about the first week, in the end of the first week, all of a sudden he doesn't show up for work on Friday. And then the next Monday, the boss says, where were you on Friday? We needed you. He says, oh, my Uncle Joe got married. I had to go back to the reservation. He says, you didn't have to go back. Well, of course I did. That was my Uncle Joe. You know? And the boss said, well, I needed you. Well, I'm here today. You know? The guy gets fired. And then all the rest of the workers say, those lousy Indians, they're lazy. They don't show up for work. This becomes a very deep offense to white America, who is used to being on time. You know, right here in Holden Village, boy, we go up at 4:05 and ring that bell. We all come around. In an Indian community, yeah, we'd say that at 4 o'clock, maybe 5 o'clock, somebody would show up.
Our church is a downtown church in Billings, Montana, and we have 2 or 3 Indians maybe every day come into our church office and say, well, I'm going to the Wotec school here in Billings now, but I have to go back to the reservation and I need some gas money.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That's true. They do. They need gas money. Indians have not prospered in our society. They are the poorest group of people in our society, by far. I'd say that 90% of Indian people are below the poverty line. And about half of them live on reservations, and most reservations are 50 to 100% unemployment. And that means they live off welfare or gifts or scrounging or what. It's real, real sad kind of thing. The other one I wanted to mention was work. The Indian tradition has not been to save up a lot of money. Most Indians couldn't care less about a bank account. And I mean that. I mean they just don't think about saving money. The Indian tradition is to work until you've got enough to get along for a few days and then you quit.
Or get drunk,
right? Sadly, that's true. And then you work a little bit more and you make enough to make some more food and get drunk and that's it. It's partly because white America has never been able to countenance that kind of an attitude toward work. And I'm not saying we should, but on the other hand, it's one of the issues that I have to talk about when I talk about Native Americans, because it's a real issue.
Isn't this historically that from in India and in Africa and South America when we colonized natives that way?
It's sure.
First time to work?
Yeah. It's a native, I think the split between what we call civilization and what native peoples all over the world call civilization is really great. And I don't know how to resolve that, but it's there.
My son is an attorney, and one time he had a case where he was defending this Indian couple and his two little boys. He said those little boys, he could have adopted them right now, but it was a case of taking the children away from the parents.
Mm-hmm.
They loved their children, but sure. They got drunk. And maybe 2-3 days, those children were by themselves.
Yeah.
And so he lost his case. The judge said, well, you did a good job, but we have to take the children away.
Yeah, yeah. Very sad.
Sad.
Yeah. Did somebody up here have a question? Yeah.
Yeah, we had a week up here at Holden this year for Native Americans, and they were guests.
They what?
They were guests this year. It was an attempt to get the Native Americans up here. And so they were guests, and it was not too successful. They had a hard time to adjust our kind of schedule and our culture. But they were here a full week. And they came from California and Washington, and there were some even from New York. I don't know how they were notified or chosen.
Yeah.
But while they were here, it was real interesting for us, you know, to try to be open and friendly. And they did have a couple of facilitators with them from Washington who are working with them particularly. I had a particular privilege because I lead the nature walks, and they did go with me.
Okay.
And I learned lots from them. But one of the comments that they made, I mean, they had such respect. They hardly talked while we were going through the woods. They sang much of the time, just hummed. It was a very spiritual kind of moment for them to do this.
Yeah.
And then the head woman said, you know what I've noticed at Holden? People up there have glazed eyes. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, they're so busy running that they don't even see anything. And she was watching them all run up to that bulletin board and check the schedule and try to make decisions appropriately. And she's right. We weren't seeing much. We were so busy doing it.
Oh. Okay. I would be of the opinion, and I don't know whether Crawler would back me up on this, but I would be of the opinion that most of our Indian friends would not be comfortable at Holden. They would not feel comfortable here. And I guess what you're saying is
bears
that out.
Right, well, we didn't feel it was very successful.
Because Holden, for all we love it and praise it, is largely a place for white middle class church people. And we are not the kind of community that is inclusive. I'm going to talk about inclusivity on Friday, and we'll...
These people all have a work ethic, so it's...
Yeah,
about
oh boy.
Down with all that
do we ever. We all have it. Yeah, did you have some?
Just a question. We talk about the Indian as if it were one...
Yeah, I tried to say that at the beginning, but
yeah. Oh, maybe I...
I didn't...
My glazed eyes, or glazed ears, could
yeah.
But are there some significant differences in beliefs from...
Between Indians?
Between the different tribes.
Yes. Yes.
I mean,
yes.
I know they didn't always get along.
No.
They,
yes, indeed. Indeed, North. Indeed. So there are 300 tribes, more or less, in this country. Now, all of them have different cultural heritages.
Yeah.
There are certain threads that run through all of them. And I'd say that most of these are threads that run through all of them.
That's what I was wondering.
A sense of oneness with nature, of the place, the land, the family, this time and work kind of thing. I think almost all Indian groups would have that kind of characteristic. But politically and spiritually and otherwise, there's a lot of differences. So they're not a unified. You can't talk about the Indian. I'm sorry about that, but...
Yeah,
well,
that was just a clarification
for
myself.
Yeah.
Crawling? Just another aside on that. This is kind of silly, but like people coming from South Dakota came to Minnesota one time, Indians, to visit some of their relatives in northern Minnesota, and they gave them as a gift wild rice. And, you know, they thought, so the South Dakota person went home with he didn't think that was much of a gift. He didn't know what
didn't know what to do with
or anything. But I mean, you know, we think that we relate to thinking that all Indians, you know, would be except wild rice. That's Indian, you know.
But I grew up in Minnesota, and I don't recall ever learning anything about the Indian, apart from by the shores of Gitche Gumee,
the big sea water.
Well, there's a whole lot of stuff that should be talked about here, and time has already gone. It's after 5. I'd like to close with a story, an actual occurrence that Carol and I participated in that I've never forgotten, and which spiritually really meant a lot to me. There was a Indian, a young man, who committed a murder in South Dakota. His name was Wesley Badheart Bull. And he was put on trial. But at the same time, a white man had murdered an Indian. In the same court, the white man was given a light sentence of 2 years, which was suspended, and he was put on parole. The Indian boy was put in prison for life. And when the Indian boy's trial came up, the mother, Sarah Badheart Bull, wanted to get into the courtroom. This was in Custer, South Dakota in the wintertime. Some of you may have heard about this, back in about 1972. Sarah wanted to go into the court, the mother of the boy on trial, but the courtroom was full. And there was a squad of police on the front steps of the court, and they forbade Sarah to go in. And so she just charged up the steps and said, "I'm going to go in, that's my son there." And a number of Indian people followed her up the steps, and the squad of police took out clubs and started to club them down the steps. And they pushed Sarah down on the icy steps, and she fell down. And we have a picture of Sarah falling back into the arms of the Indian people there. And some of the Indian people were so enraged that they picked up rocks and began to throw at the police, and a riot erupted. Well, the upshot of it was that Sarah was convicted of fomenting a riot and was sent to prison, the mother of the boy. Well, this incensed the Indians, of course, all over the area, and they gathered in Pierre, South Dakota, the capital of Pierre, some months later. About 300 Indians gathered there to bring a petition to the governor of South Dakota at the Capitol. This was on a Friday. And the governor had left the Capitol. He knew they were coming. He had locked the doors, put a squad of National Guardsmen inside of the Capitol. And Carl and I had been invited to be with these Indians. And we were there, just a few white people there. And when we gathered on the steps wondering what to do with these petitions, we looked around, and on the buildings around the Capitol, there was a square there, were squads of National Guardsmen with rifles and machine guns. And pretty soon overhead, two Army helicopters, National Guard helicopters, started pounding around, blah, 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 you know how they go, around the cap. And all of these Indians were looking up at this. And then a representative of the governor came, and he said, "The governor sent me to get these petitions," and he took this armful of petitions and he scuttled back into the Capitol building and left all the Indians standing outside.